Daniel, yeah.
When you say Korean mother, does that mean she's actually the mother of the Queen?
Yes. Yes. Yeah, the mother of the... Right, exactly. Well, even if it was a king and his mother was still alive, she would still be called the Queen Mother, because she would have been the queen of the previous king. See what I'm saying? Like, the queen's father was King George VI, so his wife was Queen Elizabeth, but she didn't have numbers because she wasn't the ruling monarch. She was simply a queen because she was married to the king. So when he dies, she retains the title of queen until she dies, but she is usually called the Queen Mother. That's the term that is usually used. Okay. There are only two. To get back to titles, you asked about titles. I mean, the Queen Mother is dead now, but the title of the monarch is His or Her Majesty. Okay. The Queen Mother also had that title, Her Majesty, because she was queen with her husband. Her father, King George VI, was the last emperor of India. So the Queen Mother was the last empress of India. She had that title as well. But Queen Elizabeth is not empress of India. India's an independent country now. Somebody else raised their hand. Lindsay, yeah.
Why is Queen Elizabeth's
husband? He's what's called the prince consort, which means he, you know, accompanies the queen. It's an awkward role, actually. Realize that most monarchs are male, okay? So it's unusual to have a female monarch. And the female monarch's husband has no political power. This is a lesson from history. Because hundreds of years ago, if you know about Elizabeth I, for example, when she was queen, remember, Elizabeth I was the one who stood up to Rome. And Elizabeth I was called the Virgin Queen. She never got married. And people believed that she remained a virgin until she died. And evidence would suggest that she did. Hollywood would suggest that she didn't, but don't take any notice of movies from Hollywood when it comes to history. But anyway, Elizabeth I had a number of men try to marry her, but this is the reason why laws were changed so that a husband marrying a monarch cannot have any political power, because guys would try to marry a female monarch thinking that they could take over and rule. You can only be born a monarch. You have to be born a monarch. And there's no other way you can become a monarch in the British or European system of monarchy. Okay? It's something that you are born to be. It comes with birth. So you cannot marry into a position, a ruling position or a reigning position. One question that I was asked in the break is why all this ceremony when the Queen was just a constitutional monarch? But I think the explanation for that is that, you know, the Queen's role is really, the role of the monarchy is really the foundation of the whole British political system. You have to kind of live in it to understand it, but the crown is the foundation upon which everything else is built. So it is the most important office in the British Commonwealth, is the position held by the monarch. The coronation ceremony itself goes back, it actually says at the beginning, into the mists of time. There's a very moving sequence near the beginning of the anointing of the Queen. And Sir Laurence Olivier is doing the narrating here, who was the great Shakespearean actor. And he mentions that, you know, this goes back into the mists of time, and it goes right back to biblical times. In fact, throughout the ceremony, if you can ever watch the whole thing, you'll see so much of biblical significance. And a lot of it just goes back to ancient Israel. The coronation ceremony has been handed down from generation to generation. Now, the Queen today remains a constitutional monarch, but let's understand, if she was involved in politics, it's doubtful that the other countries would want to retain their tie with the crown. You know, if you had a president in Britain, for example, I don't think these other countries like Canada, Australia, New Zealand, etc., would feel any loyalty. You know, they would sever the tie. So, you know, this is a unique position, and the Queen's role is extremely important. And if you look at the two political systems, the British and American system, you know, these are the two systems that have lasted the longest in the world, and given the countries the greatest period of political stability. Now, the American system has not been successfully transplanted anywhere. The British system has been. I could spend the rest of the time telling you why I think one has been and one hasn't been, but that's not the purpose of this lecture. The British system has been successfully transplanted. I was surprised when I took political science courses at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor to find that American academics look upon the British system as the superior model. I was surprised at that, and it's quite a compliment to the British system, but it's because it has lasted longer and because it has worked in a number of countries, whereas the American system hasn't. Any other questions? So, you know, it's a good system as far as human government goes. Obviously, the kingdom of God's going to be a lot better. And this system, like our system, is breaking down because of the people moving further and further away from God. We need to understand that. In fact, all of this ties in very much with Deuteronomy chapter 28, and we'll cover that tomorrow. Deuteronomy 28, the blessings and cursings chapter. We can look briefly at it right now because we need to understand something here in Deuteronomy 28. It says, "It shall come to pass, if you diligently obey the voice of the Lord your God, to observe carefully all his commandments, which I command you today, that the Lord your God will set you high above all nations of the earth." You look at that map. In 1946, the British Empire, United States, was set high above all nations of the earth. General Patton got himself into trouble because in 1945, at the end of World War II, he made the comment, "It seems as if God has given to the British and American people domination of the world for the rest of time," I think, or words to that effect, he said. And that upset Stalin. Because the Russians felt that they should be up there as well. But, you know, the Russians haven't got the ability, they haven't got the economic strength, and they haven't got the same concept of governance. Nobody wants the Russians, basically, you know. Not even the Russians want the Russians. But, you know, this is the blessing that is promised for obedience. Now, understand that when England, and England, of course, is from is where the United States came from, when England broke away from Rome and people had the freedom to read their Bibles, the Bible became the major influence in our society. You can see that when you look at our history. I mean, King Edward VIII, remember, in 1537 decreed that a copy of the Bible should be placed prominently in every church so that anybody could go in 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and read it. And the Ten Commandments were to be read in church every Sunday. And this went on for hundreds of years. It's only recently that this has really changed. You know, the enthusiasm for the Bible was such, if you remember, I told you a couple of weeks ago, that in 1546, when Henry spoke to Parliament just before he died, he had to caution people because they were reading the Bible in inappropriate places, like pubs, which is one place where you shouldn't read the Bible. And he felt that was showing disrespect to the Word of God. Elizabeth I, his daughter, when she became queen, she was a committed Protestant. And she was the one who stood up to Catholic Europe, in particular Catholic Spain, which was the dominant power in the world. The Pope gave his blessing to the Spanish to take back England, to force England back into the Catholic Church. If that had happened, we would not be sitting here today. So here was this resurrection of the beast power again that tried to bring us all under this despotic Gentile system. But now there was a religious dimension, and England had broken away. And this was the beginning of the rise to greatness of the tribe of Joseph. If you're not good at dates, and I know most people don't remember dates very well, then remember just one name, Elizabeth. Because in the time of Elizabeth I, the tribe of Joseph began its rise to greatness. In the time of Elizabeth II, it has rapidly been going into a descent into oblivion. And it all ties in with Deuteronomy 28, because the rise to greatness was due to the enthusiasm of the people for the word of God. It wasn't that the people were perfect. You still had people committing adultery. You still had fornication. You still had people stealing. But, you know, the overwhelming tenor of the people was, you know, a desire to, you know, to practice what is in the Bible. The laws of the land were based on the Bible. I mentioned to you that the sodomy laws, recently abolished by the Supreme Court, they were struck down as unconstitutional, go right back to Henry VIII's time. And they've been passed down in all the British colonies, and out of which came the United States of America, for over 400 years. Remember what Jacques Bazin, the historian, said about this enthusiasm for the Bible that he says began in the middle of the 16th century. He said, how long did it last? It lasted for 350 years. And then he says 1900 was the first year in which more secular books were published than religious books in England, which at that time was the major publisher of books in the year 1900. And of course that was the last year of Queen Victoria's reign, and that was the height of the British Empire. Everything you see colored red there was the British Empire. But the British had this enthusiasm to take the Bible into all the world. Now you also had people who wanted to go into all the world and make money. And of course the two things led eventually to the establishment of, you know, military outposts in various parts of the empire. And then you had different tribes wanting to be a part of the empire. Sometimes because some tribes were hostile or they were fighting, the British would go in and take control anyway. The British did not have a plan 400 years ago to go out and conquer the world. It just happened. I think somebody once said the British acquired their empire in a fit of madness. It was like it just kind of came one place after another until it was this big, almost a third of the world's land surface at its height. And this all came about as a result of breaking away from Rome and this commitment to the Bible. And the Bible was taken into all these different countries by missionaries, and you know, Britain remained on top for a long period of time. Then, of course, the United States took over that role that Britain had. But the decline and fall has come with the rejection of God's word. You go down to verse 15 here. It says, "It shall come to pass, if you do not obey the voice of the Lord your God, to observe carefully all his commandments and his statutes which I command you today, that all these curses will come upon you and overtake you." And he goes down and describes the curses, the negative consequences that come as a result of rejecting the laws of God. One other scripture we can look at here, and we will come back to Deuteronomy 28, but another scripture that we can look at here is, let's see, it's in Proverbs, if I can find it. Well, I'll have to tell you what it is. I've forgotten the verse right now, but it says, righteousness exalts a nation, but sin is a reproach to any people. You see, the perception in the world, certainly in Victoria's time, was that the British were righteous. Victoria was a righteous woman in a worldly sense. She did not keep the Sabbath or the holy days. She didn't understand about those. But she wasn't a woman who was, you know, going around, you know, committing adultery. And, you know, she was perceived as a righteous woman. Plus, of course, in her reign, the slaves had all been freed as a result of a decision made before her reign. But the perception was that that liberation came with Victoria, and the British were seen as liberators. And so this period of ascendancy, you know, coincided with Victoria's reign. Righteousness exalts a nation, but sin is a reproach to any people. And the more the people of Joseph have gotten into sin, the more the world has turned against us. And that was part of the reason why the British lost their empire, because, you know, of their increasing sins as a nation. Now, of course, the question then is, well, why hasn't the United States fallen as rapidly as the British Empire? But, you know, the United States came to preeminence after the British Empire. When the British Empire started to decline, America started to come into preeminence. So America kind of took over Britain's role, and, you know, America was going to go down the same road. But remember, no nation keeps its preeminence for a long period of time. You have a question? Proverbs 14:34. You know, I knew it was verse 34, I just couldn't remember the chapter. Okay, Proverbs 14:34. Yeah.
So when exactly did the empire reach its peak?
Again, it's an arbitrary date. Most historians would say the empire reached its peak around the time of Queen Victoria's Diamond Jubilee in 1897. That was when the British were so preeminent, they were beyond anybody threatening the British, the Pax Britannica, as it was called, the British peace. However, the fullest extent of its territory was not realized until after World War I, because after World War I, the League of Nations gave Britain control of Iraq, Palestine, Southwest Africa was given to South Africa, which was a part of the British Empire. Papua New Guinea was given to Australia, which was a part of the British Empire. So, you know, the League of Nations added territory to the British Empire after World War I. But by that time, Britain had been weakened in relative terms, and the United States could have, if it had wanted to at that time, could have asserted its leadership role. But America didn't want to. So again, it comes back to Deuteronomy 28. And like I said, the rise to greatness began under Elizabeth I, the decline and fall under Elizabeth II. I'm not saying the fall of America will come in the reign of Elizabeth II. You know, we might go on longer than that. I don't know. The Queen, by the way, is 78 this year. So she's getting up there in years. But her mother lived to be 101, so she still might be around a long time. But, you know, in the last... And realize, too, she's a constitutional monarch. So she is not the one who's responsible for the changes in the laws that have taken the various countries further away from God. And that applies on both sides of the Atlantic and in Australia, New Zealand, and Canada, as well as Great Britain. So let's have a look again at how the fall of this system took place, okay? Does this work? It does. Look at that. Wow. Here's the laser pointer. There's the Suez Canal, see, connecting right through there. And you see how it was a lifeline to the empire in the east. Here's Singapore, which was the British naval base. And from that naval base, the British patrolled all of this region. The British were the greatest military, the greatest naval power in the world, okay? So the Suez Canal was extremely important. And when the Suez Canal was lost, the British realized that they could not keep their empire. They could not sustain it because Britain's military might was inferior to America's, and therefore whatever America wanted, you know, America would get. So the British Empire was rapidly dismantled. To show you the significance, the importance of this, I have a quote from a book by the last white prime minister of British descent in Rhodesia. Okay, southern Rhodesia, down here. This was a colony, the only, outside of the 13 original American colonies, southern Rhodesia was the only colony that Britain had that actually rebelled against Britain and broke away from Britain. And I lived in that country and I knew the Prime Minister. That does not mean he remembers me. He was my Member of Parliament and I met him on three different occasions and talked to him for some time, and he was a very interesting man. He had, in effect, committed treason because he had declared independence from Britain. But the British government, when it dismantled its empire, wanted to get out of Africa as quick as possible. And these various countries were given independence rapidly. And when they wanted to give Rhodesia to a majority African administration, many people in Rhodesia, including many Africans, including the Matabele tribe, which was the secondary tribe, didn't want what Britain wanted, so they broke away. But they could not last, and eventually the country ended up in a civil war, and the Rhodesians were defeated. But Ian Smith wrote, who's still alive, by the way, and still lives there in what is now Zimbabwe, Ian Smith wrote a book on this called The Great Betrayal. It was about how the British and Americans betrayed Rhodesia. Not just the British and Americans, but also the South Africans, who at that time also were led by people of European descent. And he wrote this: it was the Suez Crisis that sounded the alarm. In other words, Suez was the alarm that went off and led to the end of the empire. It was the Suez Crisis that first sounded the alarm and brought those of us associated with Britain and the empire face to face with the hard reality that Britain could no longer call the tune on the international stage. The United States was now in the driving seat. constantly propagating the philosophy that colonialism was inherently bad and that the pace of its elimination had to be stepped up. I'll come back to that in a few moments. The Americans joined forces with the Russians in this anti-colonialist campaign, albeit for opposing reasons. The Russian plan was for world conquest, the takeover by Marxism-Leninism. As the metropolitan powers pulled out of their empires, as the British, the French, the Portuguese, and so on pulled out of their empires, the Russian plan was to move in. The Americans, on the other hand, believed that the presence of the colonial powers was denying them the opportunity to develop in these areas the expertise, skills, and economic success of their free enterprise system. Sadly, they seriously misjudged the situation. The second point, which should have been obvious to the USA, was that wherever Western colonialism was the vogue and the free enterprise system thriving, with American skills, capital, and equipment everywhere, big mining and industrial development, motor cars, heavy transport, earth-moving equipment, all doors were open to everybody, including the Americans. But once the Russians moved in, everyone else was frozen out. So the result turned out to be contrary to Americans' expectations. However, there is no way of correcting these mistakes. We have to live with them. This is easy for the Americans. They live 10,000 kilometers away and can go on living their own lives. The problem lies with the people on the spot who have to go on living with the disaster forced on them. Now, that's quite a criticism of American foreign policy, but I believe it's a justified criticism, and it comes back to the fact that Manasseh means forget. We forget the lessons of history. We're always looking forward to the future, and we decide things based on our own circumstances and our present reality here, and then try to impose our own way of doing things on other countries, and it doesn't work. And that's the difference between the way the British governed Africa and the Middle East and the way that, you know, we are doing things in the Middle East at this present time. But let me illustrate this a little bit deeper. All these countries colored red were a part of the British imperial trading system. The British Empire was a trading system. After the Depression at the beginning of the 1930s, the British Empire countries came out of the Depression quicker than America did. And a lot of people in the United States felt that if America could get into this trading club, then America's economic problems would be solved. And then you had the Roosevelts, Franklin Roosevelt and Eleanor Roosevelt, who were both, you know, very liberal. They believed that colonialism was wrong. They believed it was wrong for the British to have a colonial presence in India and Africa and other parts of the world, and they wanted to see that changed. So you have these two different pressures there. Now, Americans believe, I'm not saying all Americans believe this, American liberals believe, let me put that right, okay, make that clear. American liberals believed that colonialism, British colonialism in particular, held back all these countries, when the fact was exactly the opposite, that the British colonial system actually developed all these countries. Remember, Ghana, before independence, was much more prosperous than it is now. So independence has achieved nothing. And that is true in most of these countries in Africa. They have gone backwards economically since independence. Africa is the only continent that is worse off now than it was 50 years ago. Read books on that. So it went backwards, but American liberals believed, this is where political correctness comes in, that once all these countries were free of the oppressive British, then they would take off economically. And it was also believed American companies would make bigger profits because they could get in there instead of British companies, and they could make Africa as prosperous as the United States is. But of course it didn't work. The reality is now these countries here, American companies hardly do anything in those countries because you can't make money in them anymore. You could in colonial times, not as much money as they would have made at home, because Africa is not the same as the United States. But they could have made a lot of money. Anyway, Suez was the big turning point. But there was a sign of a problem even before Suez. Does anybody know what I'm talking about? Again, it's the Eisenhower administration. There was another problem before Suez that should have warned the British of what was coming. Over here, Indochina. The French ruled Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos. They were all a part of the French Empire. And after World War II, the French went back in there. The Japanese took over the area during World War II. Then the French went in after World War II. And the Vietnamese rebelled. There was a major rebellion in the north of Vietnam, led by Ho Chi Minh. And this rebellion was against the French. The French were losing. And in 1954, by the way, a very good movie on this, which is a very accurate portrayal of it, is The Honorary Consul with Michael Caine and Brendan Fraser. And it came out last year. It's from a book written by Graham Greene, who's a very perceptive writer. He's dead now, but he's a very good writer. Nathan, a quick question? Sorry? The Quiet American. I'm sorry. That's the title of the movie? Yeah, okay. I got the title wrong. The Quiet American came out last year. Forget The Honorary Consul. Is that a different book, or was that from which it came? The Honorary Consul, I think, is another book by him. So I'm glad you interrupted there. Okay? The Quiet American is a good movie to watch. But it gives you an idea as to what was happening. The French were losing this rebellion. And finally, there was a major battle at a place called Dien Bien Phu in 1954. And the French asked Eisenhower for air support for this battle. And Eisenhower deliberately, and again, you could look at the cabinet papers, Eisenhower deliberately sent them, I think it was just under half of the planes that they had requested. And so they lost. Why did he do that? Nobody else in the cabinet supported that decision. Well, I think the answer is, you know, this was the time when God had decided these empires should come to an end. But when the French lost at Dien Bien Phu, they lost Indochina. And that, of course, led to the Vietnam War. So America paid a heavy price for Eisenhower's decision. In 1956, when the Suez Canal crisis happened, again, the British and the French were forced out of the Suez Canal. Now, the French learned a lesson from those two things, 1954 and 1956. The lesson the French learned was never trust America. The lesson the British learned was Britain has to be so close to America that it can never happen again. So Britain has been America's greatest ally since then. France has been, you know, questionable ever since then. But you can understand why the French feel the way that they do, okay? And that's what it goes back to. But again, we paid a heavy price. Daniel, do I have maps of the British East there on your laptop? If I do, there is one of the British East, Middle East, in the time of the British Empire, which keep on going, because if we get to this map, it'll help illustrate a point here of the price that America has paid as a result of this. Okay? If we get to this map. Okay, well then we need to, I'll show you tomorrow. Okay. But as a result of losing Suez, Britain pulled out of the Middle East. And then America had to take over Britain's role in the Middle East. And that led eventually to the conflicts that we've got today. So you see, all of this follows on from the fall of the British Empire. And remember what Truslow Adams, the American historian, said, you know, about the collapse of the British Empire. The possible overthrow of the British Empire would be a catastrophe, scarcely thinkable. Not only would it leave a vacuum over a quarter of the globe, into which all the wild winds of anarchy, despotism, and spiritual oppression would rush, but the strongest bulwark outside ourselves for our own safety and freedom would have been destroyed. I mentioned to you yesterday seven blessings that came with the multitude of nations. Political stability was one. But you look at these countries now, there's no guarantee tomorrow morning that any of these countries will have the same government in power that they've got today. They've had such a terrible record of political instability. And without political stability, you cannot have economic development. The second blessing I mentioned was security. Not one of these nations is as secure today as it was at the time of the British Empire. And that includes Britain. Thirdly, the third thing I mentioned was freedom. Most of these countries do not have the freedoms they had during the colonial period. In most of them, the press is censored. Newspapers, radio, even television are controlled by the governments. You cannot criticize the government without, at worst, getting shot, at best, disappearing. Fourthly, law, the rule of law, is no longer operating in many of these nations. There is no law. I mean, that's often been said in Ghana. I mean, you know, when I lived there, people would say for a couple of thousand cedis, you can get rid of your wife. I wasn't tempted to do that, I might add, but I'm just saying that's what people said. A couple of thousand cedis. You just kill your wife, and then the police come, you give them 2,000 cedis, and, you know, they'll just ignore it, and you pay a doctor, you give a doctor a bottle of whiskey, and he'll write you a death certificate. That's how easy it is in some places. So, you know, the rule of law has broken down. Freedom of religion. You've got freedom of religion in many of these countries still, and that's a good thing. But in some countries it's gone, like Pakistan, for example, doesn't have freedom of religion anymore. And that's a part of what was the British Empire. Singapore doesn't allow a lot of different religious groups to operate there. Singapore is quite prosperous, but Singapore doesn't allow some of the basic freedoms that we take for granted. Sixthly, economic development. Well, again, all of this and most of the Caribbean and many parts of the Pacific have gone backwards since independence. And then, of course, point number seven, that blessing of the multitude of nations as a military force that fought the beast power and the resurrections of the beast power for a couple of hundred years, that's also gone. About Africa, I want to quote to you from a Ghanaian writer, George Ayate, who fled Ghana in 1979 during the time when Ghana had a major revolution. We were there at that time. That was when we got that 48-hour notice to leave the country. But we were there through much of this revolutionary period. And George Ayate wrote this in his book, Africa Betrayed, in 1992. He says, in Africa, there are two classes of people. The real people, the peasants, and the parasitic elites. Tyranny and intellectual repression reign over much of Africa today. Even in apartheid South Africa, this was written during the apartheid era. This is a black Ghanaian, okay, an African, writing this. Even in apartheid South Africa, blacks have greater freedom of expression than we do in our own supposedly free and independent African countries. Brutally terrorized by their government and crocodile liberators, most Africans now live in a cocoon of fear, afraid even to whisper innocuous political comments. Ghanaians aptly have named this a culture of silence. He mentions that Africa has been conquered three times. The first time was the Arabs. The next time were the European explorers and missionaries who came. He said a third and far more insidious invasion began under black male colonialism. In fact, what he's saying is the end of the colonial period, there was another invasion. And listen carefully to this invasion, because we need to understand the world in which we live. Africa is the continent Americans understand least, just as South America is the continent the British understand least, because we've had the least to do with it. Americans have not had much to do with Africa. But one third of African countries today are in the middle of wars. And often the question comes up, why doesn't America do something about it? But let's understand why we have these problems in Africa. A third invasion began under black neocolonialism. So the colonial system was replaced by a neocolonialism, another form of colonialism, which was different and turns out to be worse. Educated abroad and having assumed the trappings of foreign cultures and ideologies, a new wave of invaders struck Africa. They were actually returnees, sons of Africa, who briefly left to pursue studies overseas or to go into exile. But they came back with a vengeance, to denigrate, to enslave, to destroy, and to colonize by imposing alien ideological systems upon the African people. You see, in colonial times, students from a country like Ghana, which was called the Gold Coast when it was ruled by the British, they would go to London for higher education. People in the French countries would go to Paris for higher education. Ho Chi Minh from Vietnam was educated in Paris. Then they would go back to their own countries. And later on, these people became the leaders of their own countries. The ideas they brought back from the universities in England, in France, also in the United States, the ideas were the ideas that we today would call political correctness, of socialism, of liberalism. And they came back with those ideas, and they tried to impose socialism on their own people, and it was disastrous. And that's what George Ayate is saying. They were heavily influenced by Marxist, Leninist thinking. But it also appealed to people who came out of African culture, because in the culture of Africa, you know, the guy at the top is in charge. The chief has great say in everything. And, you know, these leaders would go back, and, you know, everything was controlled from the top. Everything was owned at the top. They took, you know, the wealth for themselves. So he continues. The economic exploitation and political repression of the African people continued unabated. More treacherous, perhaps, was the continued denigration and, in some cases, the destruction of indigenous African institutions and culture by the very African nationalists and heads of state who claimed to have liberated Africa. And then he asked the question, from what was Africa liberated? Economically, politically, and culturally, Africans today are worse off than they were at the time of independence in the 1960s. 3 decades of independence from colonial rule have produced nothing but economic misery and disintegration, political chaos, and institutional and social decay. What did James Truslow Adams say? The fall of the British Empire would leave a vacuum over a quarter of the globe into which all the wild winds of anarchy, despotism, and spiritual oppression would rush. And that's exactly what's happened. And this is the world in which we live today. A much more complicated world than we had at the end of World War II. Because at the end of World War II, there were about 50 countries in the world. Today there are almost 200 countries in the world. And most of these countries are what President Bush called failed states. They have not succeeded in becoming countries. They were given their independence by a previous generation that thought that independence was the right thing to do. PC, political correctness. The liberal ideas of the 1950s and 60s. But they've not been able to stand on their own 2 feet. So in many of these countries now, you've got chaos, you've got anarchy, you've got a breakdown of just about everything. In many Caribbean countries, which at one time were a part of the British trading system, in many countries now, because their economies have collapsed, they basically are just centers for drugs and sex. And the same with Africa. I was told that by a British airline stewardess that roughly 10% of the passengers on every plane going from Ghana to England are smuggling drugs, usually heroin, which they swallow in condoms and then pass when they get to England. And those drugs come, by the way, from Colombia into Brazil, and then they're flown on the Brazilian airline by passengers to Nigeria, and then they're dispersed across West Africa to the various countries and then taken to Europe. A very circuitous route, but very profitable. And part of the training now of airline stewardesses is how to cope when somebody ODs on the plane. As if terrorism isn't bad enough, you know? You've got to check the person sitting next to you, you've got to check their shoelaces. And of course, even when you check their shoes, they might still suddenly go into convulsions because they've got heroin in their stomach and a condom's burst. I mean, you know, it's getting ridiculous, some of these things, but that's the way it is. But you see, it's the only way some people can make money because of the economies that have collapsed in this part of the world. And as the economies have collapsed, so you've also got rising civil disorder. And you've also got a return to tribalism. When the British ruled these countries, the tribes were treated generally equally. But once you have independence, the man at the top must come from one tribe, and he will favor his own tribe over other tribes. So then you have a possibility of a civil war, because the other tribes want to get what the favored tribe has got. And it just goes on and on and on as a never-ending cycle. So you see, this system that we see here of the multitude of nations, you know, was overall a blessing. It was not perfect. And I hope nobody goes away with that feeling. It was not perfect by any means. You know, there were lots of things that were not good. But nothing better has replaced it. That's the point I'm making here. Nothing better has replaced it. And it's left a vacuum all over the globe. Fortunately, when this system collapsed, the United States was able to continue the role that the multitude of nations had had for a couple of hundred years. The United States becoming the preeminent military superpower, the United States being the country which now tries to stop any tyrant or any despot from conquering the world, which was the role that these countries, the red countries, the British Empire countries, had prior to America. But again, let's just get back to the fall of the British Empire. You had the Eisenhower administration in 1956 forced Britain and France out of Suez. Now, what can we learn from this? I mentioned that a major turning point was the fall of Singapore in 1942. The perception of people changed, because for the first time, a non-white power of people that were looked down upon and considered primitive defeated the greatest military power in the world in Singapore in 1942. And this sent a signal to people that the British Empire was not what it was, that it was not omnipotent, that it was not impregnable, that it could be defeated. So that was the first crack in the system. 1956, 14 years later, the loss of the Suez Canal was the end of the British Empire, because then Britain realized it just could not any longer do what it wanted to do, that America was the preeminent power. What were the two things then that brought about the fall? Basically, what it was Britain was overly committed militarily around the world, and Britain could no longer afford it. And that was what finally caused America to pull the plug. The United States was able to apply economic pressure. Now, it is my considered opinion that we've had our fall of Singapore, and that was September the 11th. Because the perception of the United States around the world changed on September the 11th. Because here were people who were primitive, barbarians, whatever term you want to use, but that's the perception. You know, these were primitive peoples, you know, from the Middle East, who were able to attack America at the very heart of its most important commercial center. And there was nothing we could do. And so I have noticed, and so have others who traveled, a very different perception of America today to what you had before September the 11th. Could Iraq be our Suez? We don't have the support of most of the countries of Europe in Iraq, certainly not the two key countries, France and Germany. What you see now is that economic power is moving to Europe as the dollar declines and the euro rises. Could Europe pull the plug on America as America pulled the plug on the British Empire? It doesn't matter that Britain had all those troops. You saw them all at the Queen's coronation. Having all those troops doesn't mean a thing if you haven't got the money to fight the wars, or if other countries can put on you the economic pressure. You know, the real problem, and what this comes down to, and again it comes back to Deuteronomy 28, is the prophecy, you know, that as the Israelites would be blessed, you shall be the head, and you shall not borrow from others, you shall lend to others. But then the curse is the reverse, that you will be the tail. You know, the Gentiles will be the head, you will be the tail. And, you know, you will have to borrow from others. And we've been borrowing for a heck of a long time. And we'll pick this up tomorrow, okay, when we look at this a little bit more and get into Deuteronomy chapter 28.